This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
But what we're trying to do is stop the business model of criminal gangs who are preying on people, moving them across the channel in unseaworthy vessels, risking their lives and sometimes costing their lives.
That was British Prime Minister Boris Johnson defending his government's plan to start sending illegal migrants to Rwanda. Details coming up. Also, gunmen kidnap 30 wedding guests in northwest Nigeria. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Tribal clashes over the past week in the town of Kulbas in West Darfur province has killed around 100 people. Abkar Altoum, a tribal leader in the town, said the dead include at least 62 bodies found burned after militias set more than 20 villages on fire. He said many people were still unaccounted for. He claimed the attackers gained control of water resources, aggravating the humanitarian situation in the area. He did not elaborate. The Associated Press, quoting the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR, says the fighting grew out of land dispute between Arab and African tribes in Kulbas. The latest bout of tribal violence in Darfur comes as the country remains mired in a wider crisis following an October military coup. Since late last year, eruptions of tribal violence and surges in the fighting in Darfur have killed hundreds. In April, after a similar bout of clashes killed over 200, the Sudanese military said it deployed a brigade to the province. However, the latest violence has raised questions over where Sudanese military leaders are capable of bringing security to Darfur. Residents are fleeing Bunagana in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo after the M23 militia seized the key border town. The news is a setback for the DRC army, the FRDC, which said yesterday the insurgents were on the run. The town is just a few kilometers from the Rwanda border. The DRC government again accused the Rwanda government of backing the M23, which is primarily Congolese Tutsi militia, one of the more than 120 armed groups active in eastern DRC. Rwanda denies the accusations and has said the DRC is harboring a group of Hutu fighters accused of being involved in the 1994 genocide in which nearly 1 million Tutsis and their Hutu supporters died. Reporter Jafar Al-Ketanti is now in the town of Kiwanja, where DRC troops have been based. He spoke with VOA's Kate Bond Dawson today and says Bunagana has changed hands several times recently.
In the last 2 weeks, Bunagana was being attacked by M23 four times. And it's because this city is very important for them. It's a big border with a national road, and as they are in Rwanda and their fighters are in Rwanda and Uganda, controlling Bunagana is good for them because that allows them to supply their troops in the DRC.
I understand the DRC government, the government in Kinshasa, is blaming Rwanda for allowing the M23 to operate there, and even says the Rwandan government has provided support. What is Rwanda saying about that? What's going on between the two countries as they argue over this issue?
There is a tension between the two countries. DRC is accusing Rwanda and can also prove with some evidence like the Rwandan soldiers captured by locals in DRC. So for the DRC government, Rwanda is supporting M23, but Rwanda don't accept it. They every time say they can't support M23, they can't be involved in Congolese problem as M23 are former Congolese officers. Every time when a rocket, because Rwanda says some rocket launched from DRC land in Rwanda, and when Rwanda has to respond on that, they also launch many rockets in DRC direction. For example, last Friday, there was a statement of Rwanda saying that two rockets landed in Rwanda, and for responding to that, they launched five rockets in DRC. So the tension is not good between Rwanda and Rwandan government and Congolese government.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Katanti speaking by phone from Kiwanja in the eastern DRC. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pondawson. In the latest of a surge of mass abductions hitting the region, gunmen kidnapped 30 wedding guests in northwest Nigeria over the weekend. According to the French news agency AFP, the victims, all mobile phone traders, were returning to the Zamafra state capital, Gusau, late Saturday after the wedding of a colleague in neighboring Sokoto state. They were seized after one of their four vehicles broke down. Police in Sokoto and Zamafra did not immediately respond to AFP inquiries on the incident. Northwest and central Nigeria is a hub of criminal gangs who attack villages and highways, killing and abducting residents and drivers, and looting and burning homes. Last week, 58 residents were kidnapped when gunmen invaded Kiwari village in nearby Katsina state, according to local officials. The criminal gangs, who the government has officially declared terrorists, maintain camps in Rugu Forest, straddling Zamfara, Katsina, Kaduna, and Niger states. The gangs are driven by financial motives, but security sources say they are increasingly forging alliances with jihadists from the northeast, waging a more than a decade-long insurrection. President Muhammadu Buhari addressed the nation for his last Democracy Day before he hands over power next May. His administration declared the 12th of June every year as Democracy Day 4 years ago. That was the date in 1993 when Moshood Abiola won the vote for president. The military overturned the election and he never took power. Reporter from Abuja, Nigeria, tells us more.
In his address to the nation at 7 a.m. Sunday morning, President Buhari promised Nigerians that his administration will conduct a free, fair, and transparent elections in 2023.
Fellow Nigerians, this is my last Democracy Day speech as your president. By June 12, 2023, exactly 1 year from today, you will already have a new president. I remain committed and determined to ensure that the new president is elected through a peaceful and transparent process.
President Buhari also condemned the military government led by retired General Ibrahim Babangida that annulled the vote and transitioned to democracy 30 years ago. He described the Babangida government as the worst Nigerians have ever had. Buhari also talked of the government's commitment to national security. He told the nation that the cybersecurity and surveillance systems of the country are being upgraded to enhance the government's ability to track and trace criminal activities.
We have reformed some of our security structures. Some of the defense assets we procured 3 years ago have arrived and have been deployed.
This year's Democracy Day celebration in Nigeria is significant as it is the last for Buhari's government. Political analyst Jide Ojo commended the president for appraising the general situation of the country, but also pointed some topics he said were missing in the Democracy Day speech.
The president was very silent on many other aspects. The issue of anti-corruption, he didn't say anything. The issue of governance deficit, the fact that even the electioneering process is highly monetized. The president deliberately did not say anything about the obscene monetization of the party primaries that ended on June 9th, 2022.
Also reacting to the President's Democracy Day broadcast, human rights lawyer Frank Tete said the speech was full of contradictions.
A Democracy Day speech is not a time to remind Nigerians of the progress that government has made, which they have neither felt nor seen. Whatever achievement the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari has made, all have been blighted by the present state of insecurity, the worst ever since the Civil War of 1967.
In commemoration of this year's Democracy Day, the government has unveiled activities for the celebration and also declared Monday, June 13th, as a public holiday. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
Meteorologists predict that La Niña weather phenomenon is likely to persist into next year, prolonging devastating drought conditions in the Horn of Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization says La Niña, which started in 2020, will continue until at least August and might persist into 2023. La Niña refers to the large-scale cooling of ocean surface temperatures in the central and eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says La Niña affects temperatures and rainfall patterns in different parts of the world. She says it also exacerbates drought and flooding.
So the ongoing drought in the Horn of Africa and southern South America, you know, bear all the hallmarks of La Niña, as does the above average rainfall in Southeast Asia and Australasia, as well as the predictions for an above average hurricane season in the Atlantic.
The WMO says all naturally occurring climate events such as La Niña now take place in the context of human-induced climate change. Though La Niña has a cooling influence, it says temperatures are continuing to rise due to global warming. That could spell bad news for the Horn of Africa, where millions of people are suffering from acute hunger due to four consecutive years of failed rains. Nullis notes the hoped-for rains once again have failed to come during the March to May rainy season in Somalia, parts of Kenya, and Ethiopia.
And now there is a real risk that the October to December rainy season could fail. So should these forecasts materialize, then obviously the humanitarian situation will become even more acute.
Last month, 14 meteorological and humanitarian agencies issued a joint alert. They warned that the extreme widespread drought affecting Somalia and parts of Kenya and Ethiopia could lead to mass starvation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. In South Africa, there's concern about how long it's going to take the United Arab Emirates to extradite two brothers accused of stealing billions of dollars. A commission of inquiry has found that Atul and Rajesh Gupta, along with their brother Ajay, conspired with former President Jacob Zuma to loot state-owned enterprises. Here's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Jacob Zuma is accused of awarding dubious contracts to members of the wealthy Gupta family when he became South Africa's president in 2009. The alleged corruption peaked in the final 4 years of Zuma's presidency, from 2014 to 2018. A commission of inquiry says that's when Atul, Rajesh and AJ Gupta, Zuma and other African National Congress officials stole at least 500 billion rands, or $32 billion. The commission says, as a result, government companies suffered, resulting in serious service delivery failures, including frequent electricity blackouts and the breakdown of rail transportation. The Guptas and Zuma repeatedly have denied breaking any laws or acting corruptly. None have been convicted of any charges. State prosecutors are talking with authorities in the United Arab Emirates to get Atul and Rajesh Gupta to South Africa to begin answering the charges against them. UAE officials arrested the two brothers earlier this month. Henny van Vieren is director of Open Secrets, a non-profit organization dedicated to exposing corruption. He doubts extradition will happen quickly, based on the UAE's actions so far. He points out that the media knew about the Gupta arrests before the South African Justice Department.
It puts the South African authorities in the back foot to the extent that they now have to organize a crack team. The A team of South African prosecutors have to get on a plane and get to Dubai urgently to ensure that these wanted criminals are not allowed to be given bail so that they can escape to their bolt holes in India or Uzbekistan and wherever else they've stashed the cash they've stolen from South Africans.
Van Vieren says organized crime groups have been laundering money through Dubai for decades.
Dubai, as we popularly know it, is a shopping destination for the very wealthy in South Africa, is also an international center for the world's criminal economy. Those shiny towers in the desert have partly been built off illicit financial flows, money that's often stolen wealth from countries on the African continent, in Asia and elsewhere, and they use the...
Earlier this year, the Intergovernmental Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, placed the UAE on its grey list of countries associated with serious money laundering. The FATF is run by the Group of Seven Democracies, and its investigators track illicit financial flows around the world. Van Vieren says the UAE's grey listing threatens the future of Dubai as an international centre of trade and commerce. The UAE government, he says, is engaged in damage control to try to get off the list.
The UAE is very happy to arrest the Guptas. It sends a strong message to London and to Paris and Washington, D.C. that they are tough on money laundering because they're going after these international criminals. Whether they'll actually see that through is questionable. And one of the reasons is that the courts aren't independent, and their interest is not necessarily to upend the system that's made Dubai rich. They need to keep that system running. There may be the look of justice that's about to happen, but I think we're up against an enormous legal battle if the South Africans...
Authorities in the UAE have assured South Africa that their justice system is strong and fair, and that the Guptas will be handled just like any other people facing extradition. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A British judge has rejected a challenge to the country's agreement to have illegal migrants sent to Rwanda, setting the stage for the first flight to leave tomorrow. The agreement between the two countries had come under criticism from refugee and human rights groups. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson claims the plan is aimed at stopping people trafficking gangs. Johnson claims the plan is aimed at stopping people trafficking gangs, saying they are selling people a false hope. They are luring them into something extremely risky and criminal.
But what we're trying to do is stop the business model of criminal gangs who are preying on people, moving them across the channel in unseaworthy vessels, risking their lives and sometimes costing their lives. But it's worse than that. What they're doing is undermining people's confidence in legal migration and people's support for legal migration. We have safe and legal routes for people to come into this country.
Amid accusations that some of the migrants claim they were tortured in their home countries and fear being sent back, Rwanda's High Commissioner Johnston Busingye insists his country will be a safe haven for migrants. As of Friday, up to 130 people had been notified they could be deported, among them asylum seekers who have experienced torture and trafficking. But the court was told that 31 people were scheduled to be on the first flight, then 15 of them had their tickets cancelled. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, Kenyan companies that unload freight ships and transport cargo faced growing competition from international shippers. Now, workers' unions say unless steps are taken to protect local businesses, an estimated 1,000 firms and 10,000 jobs may be lost. Juma Majanga reports from the port of Mombasa, Kenya.
Peter Otieno, a clearing and forwarding agent at the port of Mombasa, says his business is still recovering from the impact of the pandemic. Now, he is worried about competing with international shipping lines, which have started offering full services previously done by Kenyan businesses.
The shipping lines can come here, open their offices, then after opening the offices, they do even clearing, they do the transport.
Kenya has no commercial shipping vessels. According to the Shippers Council of Eastern Africa, foreign-owned shipping lines control up to 92% of Kenya's international freight trade. The law previously restricted global shipping lines from providing added services, leaving more business for local companies. But since winning a Kenyan court case in 2017, these shipping lines have consolidated cargo unloading, forwarding, and other services in what is called a vertical integration model. Workers' unions argue international shippers have an advantage because they make initial contact with the clients and can offer them full services first, costing local jobs and business. Leonard Njiru is the Mombasa branch chairman of the Kenya International Freight and Warehousing Association.
In the last 1 year, here in Mombasa, we have lost almost 50 members who are operating companies, now not operating.
The World Trade Organization Safeguard Framework allows member countries to develop regulations to protect local companies from unfair competition. In this case, local businesses say they are being hurt by uncompetitive practices. The Shippers Council of Eastern Africa backs the vertical integration model, saying it streamlines operations, improves efficiency, and is a global model that is here to stay. But the council adds it understands the workers' concerns and is calling on Kenya to adapt regulations to address job losses. Gilbert Langat is the chief executive officer of the council.
So what we need is to have regulations that are actually able to control how this happens. That when even when it happens, our interests as a region, as a Kenya, as a corridor, as locals, are taken care of.
Freight companies at the port of Mombasa, already struggling to deal with the impact of the pandemic, fear they will be pushed out of business. Here again is Peter Otieno.
We need to defend the clearing and forwarding companies that are operating in this country, which is the investment of the local Kenyans.
Industry insiders in Kenya say without measures to protect them, local companies may be dealt a fatal blow. Juma Majanga for VOA News, the port of Mombasa, Kenya.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, John Walker, thanks for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and